Over NBC's Coast to Coast network of independent affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. Today, the Roundtable discusses the Schuman Plan. What does it mean to Britain and Europe? We first hear Alan Simpson, historian of the University of Chicago. Now, Mr. Simpson.
During the past week, delegates of six nations have been discussing a spectacular French proposal for the consolidation of Western Europe, the Schuman Plan. This is a plan which is trying to bring the production of European coal and steel under the control of a common European authority. But Foreign Minister Schuman and his planning expert, Monsieur Jean Monnet, have made it clear that the importance of the plan is not to be measured solely in terms of coal and steel production. For them, it is a symbol of a united and regenerated Europe, and they've applied themselves with unconventional vigor to the task of firing the imagination and stiffening the resolution of European opinion. In one aspect, its Franco-German features, it is a plan which endeavors, in Mr. Churchill's phrase, to dismiss the fierce, destructive strife of Gaul and Teuton into the fading romance of history. In another, it makes an important contribution to the ideal of a federated Europe. Mr. Schuman has stipulated from the first that independent governments should transfer a portion of their sovereignty to an international body. This is not just another alliance like the Atlantic Pact, nor an agreement like the European Payments Union. It is absolutely new. The United States of America has been promoting European unity since the close of the last war. The Marshall Plan Administrator, Mr. Hoffman, has continuously kept the ideal of an integrated Europe before European nations. The Schuman Plan has the full sympathy and support of the American administration. Germany, Italy, Holland, Belgium, and Luxembourg have responded to the French initiative, at least to the extent of sharing in the exploration of a project whose dimensions are still as vague as they are vast. Great Britain, while remaining in friendly contact with the French, has felt unable to take part in the Paris discussions. This British abstention has been condemned by some as a deplorable example of isolationism, and accepted by others as a natural, and not necessarily harmful, result of a well-known divergence between the British and the French approach to European unity. Perhaps you, Hans Morgenthau, professor of political science at the University of Chicago, can shed some light on this conflict of opinion.
Simpson, it is not surprising that such a conflict of opinion exists. For the national interests of France involved in this proposal are quite different from those of Great Britain. For France, this is a last heroic attempt to solve the German problem once and for all.
Well, we are fortunate today to be able to let the French speak for themselves. His Excellency, Monsieur Henri Bonnet, French ambassador to the United States, will now describe the Schuman Plan as it appears to the government which sponsored it. We take you now to Washington.
After the most destructive wars in history, it is natural that the ideal of European unity should acquire new strength. But to the political obstacles, a long past of rivalries, feuds, wars, which prevented its realization in the last century, have been added immense difficulties in the economic field as a result of the Industrial Revolution and of the development behind custom barriers and other means of protection of national economic systems, widely different in many respects. During the past years, many attempts have been made to promote unity in Western Europe. Results have been obtained in the commercial field under the impulse of the Marshall Plan. A Council of Europe composed of representatives of 11 European nations has also been created in Strasbourg. But this achievement has been slow according to the popular wish for a closer cooperation between the nations of the old continent. This is why the French cabinet felt that a striking decision had to be made to further the integration of European economies, and that the only way to obtain this result was to break down in a vital field, decisively, once for all, the walls which until now had prevented the development of a true and unhampered cooperation in Europe. For this momentous act, the French government chose the field of Franco-German relations and that of the essential heavy industries, coal and steel. Once reached a successful decision, its political and economic consequences will be tremendous. First of all, it would mean the end of the Franco-German wars. The heavy industries of the two countries would be placed under a high authority, representing public interest and directly supervised by public opinion. There would be no possibility left for secret preparations for war, such as occurred under Hitler after 1933. Indeed, as it was stated by the French cabinet, war between France and Germany would become not only unthinkable, but materially impossible. At the same time, a striking answer would be given to the communist propaganda that the Western nations are preparing for war. For the main purpose of this new industrial union is to increase the capacity of production of the participating countries and to use it for constructive and peaceful projects. Under the impulse of the high authority, programs of modernization and of economic expansion featuring better methods and better organization will be determined and carried out. More important still, custom duties on steel and coal, quotas, preferential tariffs, and other similar protective measures will be suppressed, opening a broader market to 150 million people, and to even more should other neighboring nations join in the proposed union. Within these markets, products of the industries concerned will be available to everyone on equal terms. Conditions favorable to free competition, such as exists today in the United States, will be created. Last but not least, the plan will ensure a higher standard of living to the industrial workers of the area concerned. It is understood that for the creation of this broader market, conditions of production must be equalized. But this equalization must be made at the highest level of salaries and not entail a reduction of the buying power of the workers. Undoubtedly, such a powerful industrial nucleus as will be constituted by the Union of the Industries, of the Ruhr, of Benelux, of northern and eastern France can help fulfill the promise of social progress as well as of greater prosperity. Artificially divided today into three parts by frontiers and by custom barriers, it will later become a powerful unit on the scale of American industry. We cannot allow ourselves to fail, said Mr. Schuman a few days ago at the opening meeting of the negotiations in Paris. The hopes which have been raised, not only in Europe but also here in America, must not be deceived. I shall mention only the two most important. One is that a close and friendly cooperation with the United States will be immensely facilitated and strengthened if Europe is unified and reorganized. You certainly realize that the Marshall Plan has already greatly helped us. It has rekindled our self-confidence and given us the courage to launch our bold proposal. The new steps being envisaged will contribute no less efficiently to make a living community of the Atlantic world, a world of peace and democracy. The second prospect offered by the Schuman Plan is that it will mark the beginning of a united Europe. First of all, because the economic cooperation in the domain of coal and steel industry will necessarily entail further developments in other fields. Already, we hear that negotiations are being conducted by the farmers of the interested countries. But What is still more important is that decisive progress in the sphere of international institutions will be made. The industrial union will pave the way for a political union. The powers of the high authority placed at the head of the pool will be incorporated in a treaty to be ratified by the parliament. Once the treaty is ratified, the decisions of the high authority will be binding on all signatories. This drastic measure, amounting to the constitution of an international administration, entails other equally bold innovations. Above the high authority itself, there will be an arbitration court and a parliamentary body of representatives elected by the parliaments of the six countries. Thus, in addition to an executive body, we will have the nucleus of a European judiciary and parliamentary system. For the first time in modern history, Europe is on the road to unity. She has drawn the strength to start on this new and promising road from her own misfortunes, from her will to work and to achieve her recovery, and from the generous and friendly help extended to her by the United States.
We return you now to Chicago.
Thank you, Ambassador Bonnet, for your excellent presentation of the Schuman Plan.
We have heard a very persuasive presentation of the French point of view. Why, then, haven't the British been persuaded?
Well, of course, there have been more angles than one to this plan from the first moment of its very bold and unconventional inception. Let's hear the statement of the British case. Mr. Frederick Coole, foreign correspondent of the Chicago Sun-Times, will present it from London. Mr. Coole.
A burst of approval greeted the Schuman Plan when first announced over 6 weeks ago. People were cheered by its political portent. At last, they said, here's something that can prevent war between those habitual enemies, France and Germany. But this glint of sanity has been followed by doubts. These doubts are not confined to the British, who are standing aside from the six governments now conferring in Paris on Schuman's proposals. Without hunting trouble, we may soon see dissension among those six participating governments themselves. Western Germany welcomed the offer to pool Europe's coal and steel industries. Plain Germans hoped this was a chance not just to bury the hatchet with France, but once more to stand erect among the European family. The Adenauer government and German industrialists also had a more immediate expectation. A scheme for enlarging production, they thought, would lift the Allied lid on German steel production and let output rise in Europe's greatest concentration of industry, in the Ruhr. But a few days ago, Schuman declared that the existing limitation of German steel production will be maintained. That's hardly the last word. If it were, German enthusiasm would quickly evaporate. For Western Germany's rulers, the Schuman project seemed to breach the walls imprisoning a defeated nation. The road ahead, they thought, leads to freedom, equality, and a little beyond, to prestige and power. But is that Schuman's purpose? Or is it rather to put German key industries under a supreme planning board in which German interests would be a minority? When Schuman said Allied controls will stay fastened on German industry, German hope shriveled. To most French people, Franco-German equality today would mean German supremacy tomorrow. Some of Schuman's closest advisors, whose advice in this case has been ignored, are uneasy at what's happening. These high-ranking French officials see France almost alone in the company of a resurgent Germany. They would feel much safer if Britain were in there pitching with them. Why has Britain stayed on the sidelines? Is it because the British Labour government refuses to cooperate with non-socialist governments in Europe? A couple of blundering phrases in a recent Labour Party pamphlet conveyed that impression. But the evidence contradicts it. Even now, Britain is about to join a European payments union, which will ease and expand trade among all the Marshall Plan countries. Labour Britain is marching in step with her non-socialist partners in the Atlantic Pact. She's at one with France, Belgium, Holland, and Luxembourg in the Brussels Treaty, a political and military alliance. The British are faithfully carrying out dozens of trade agreements with anti-socialist governments.